The next topic here is entitled Collaborating Secure the Digital Economy. And I'm really excited about this panel because we have had a really important history in this country of collaboration, which has made a difference. And we're going to have future, we're going to have deeper collaboration going into the future. So again, we can go in whatever way we want. We can start start with Tom and Viola from the UC system here, and move across the panel as we did before. I think that's probably the most effective way to do it. Okay. Well, Tom, thank you for joining us today, and thanks for having us here.
So, thank you very much. I very much appreciate the opportunity to participate in the panel and to share some perspective. And I'm going to do this from a little bit of a different perspective. I'm going to talk on behalf of kind of being a chief information officer and really trying to help the university protect itself and defend itself against these cyber attacks. And then also our role as a set of research universities in terms of the collaborative ecosystem that we need to do a job to create. But let me start talking just a little bit about, you know, as I don't consider myself a cybersecurity expert. I consider myself someone who has invested a tremendous amount of time in understanding cyber risk. In my role with the university as chief information officer, I touch technology on a very broad spectrum. Everything from the mundane in terms of helping us manage our infrastructure and its costs and our migrations to the cloud, to really looking at something as challenging as keeping an open research environment in a set of research universities while trying to protect us against the various actors that are around the world. And so when you think of the University of California system with its 10 campuses, touching about 240,000 students every year, our five medical centers touching 14 million patients, our relationship with three national laboratories, we play in some of the most affected industries such as healthcare, higher education, R&D in terms of where this activity is happening and the valuable assets that the bad actors are trying to ascertain. And so, and on the other side of that, we bring all of this incredible knowledge and talent to look at problems, whether they're directly related to the space or in adjacent domains that we could throw and participate in terms of trying to managing these challenges. And then, of course, you have the history of our university system where many industries that have developed the University of California campuses and the laboratories have played a key role. When you're talking about biotech, computing, semiconductors, and even agriculture, the university has a rich history of playing a role in terms of how do we tackle these problems, whether we're talking about the agrarian age, the industrial age, the information age, and now in the digital age. And so I'm going to talk about the challenges as a CIO of managing an open research environment. Because the nature of our work, whether it's touching our students and planting the seeds of knowledge for their future, or the faculty research driving the boundaries of science and discovery, we require a very open environment, and we have to find the balance in that environment such that we can maintain academic freedom, the exchange of ideas, and the collaboration of our researchers with researchers around the world, realizing those researchers sit in the same location as some of the bad actors that we're trying to protect ourselves against. And that's incredibly challenging as an organization. But it's all part of our mission, because when you look at the mission of the university and whether we're trying to help patients receive the latest treatments, or trying to help farmers increase their yields, or trying to create cleaner air for our citizens to breathe, this is the demands of what our mission is driving us towards, and that requires that we maintain a very open environment. And so as a CIO, I'm constantly looking at this from the standpoint of cyber risk, because to me, and I work with the executives of our campuses and our medical centers and the labs, and we talk about the balances that we're trying to strike as an organization of being very open and collaborative, at the same time being very realistic about the challenges of today, and where do those balances, whether they're around openness, whether they're around privacy, whether they're around the cost and investment that we make towards those particular topics. How do we balance it all? Because every dollar that you spend towards cybersecurity, in theory, is a dollar you're taking away from the student experience. okay, or from, you know, the advancement of science. And so these are the very real challenges that we see as an organization, and they're significant challenges. You put on top of that, you know, the compliance aspect of federal and state privacy regulations, the fact that, you know, that these actors, whether they be nation states or syndicates, you know, are after a lot of valuable assets that we have within the university. And it's not just personal identities. It's also, you know, research data around a lot of very, very interesting topics. And we think about some of the actors we're talking about with very long-term perspectives, the ability to take, to harvest different types of information that they hold on to and may only act on 10 or 15 years later is something that we have to think about as an institution, both individually but also collectively. And so our journey, and we had a very public attack last year that forced a very public announcement in terms of what might have happened. You know, it was, as was mentioned in the first panel, kind of a crisis that we needed to take advantage of. And so, I like to talk about a continuum that swings from an underappreciation of these risks to one that is an overreaction and an unrealistic sense of urgency, back to a place where we have what I'll call a mindset of a balance of conversation and a mindset of that this is a long-term problem for the university to manage. And so, you know, much of what we've struggled with as an organization, and I think all organizations, be them large or small, is one of social engineering in terms of understanding the level of risk that we're dealing with. We've convened a governance structure that has members from academic administration, business administration, the faculty directly, and technology, where before our very public event, it was very much just a technology conversation, and we needed to really make it a, you know, institutional risk conversation. We've adopted some of the strategies in terms of the international standards for assessing risk, measuring risk, the metrics that we want to use, but also understanding how to value our assets and realizing that all assets that we have are not necessarily equal. Modernizing technology, we are taking advantage. We haven't always, if you think of one of the reasons why healthcare and higher education experienced, I won't say the most attacks, but I think you have the most visibility on the attacks, is the way that our industries are designed. They are much more fragmented in nature, and it makes them more difficult. And I think that's why you see a little bit more success and a little bit more of publicity around them. But the technology has helped, but our ability to coordinate across our locations in a way that we didn't before, moving away from thinking of ourselves as individual campuses or individual medical centers to a coordinated front, has established the ability to better protect ourselves and as well as to respond ourselves. You know, we've seen orders of magnitude improvement through that coordination that says, you know, when we detect a bad actor or a particular attack profile, we're able to look across our entire system now at all locations and be able to say, we see this there. Now, corporations that have a much more locked down environment, this is kind of standard fare, but for an open environment, collaborative environment like higher education, like healthcare, where there is a lot of sharing of information that happens now between medical professionals, this is something that's daunting, and that's something that we're getting better at. And maybe most importantly, and the hardest part, is the cultural change. Just, you know, raising the level of awareness of the entire organization, top to bottom, whether it's with our students who walk into our campuses as digital natives, and an inherent trust in that I just go to my bank account on my phone and I transfer from one account to another. They're pushing us because more of how they want us to interact with them is in a digital nature, and they expect us to do a good job in creating those digital interactions in a trustful environment. So the cultural change and the training programs that we've put on have given us a tremendous opportunity to improve on what we do today. We look at some of those examples that I talk about where I think the collaboration opportunities are for us, and the fact that we are a living laboratory of multiple organizations, even though we're under one umbrella. The fact that we do a better job of sharing information is something that, as we looked at what could be a lot better today, you know, sharing information across intelligence, information sharing for detecting and responding, it's at a certain level today, but it's fallen short of where we need. You know, there are not enough people inside the circle of trust. There are too many rules that are in place that we experience on a organizational level as we want to reach out. We have great relationships with law enforcement locally at every level, but it's not a seamless, you know, it's kind of a, you know, we're outside of the circle of trust, and then we make the phone call, we make the contact, and then we get into the circle of trust, and it's only for that particular incident. So we see information sharing as something that can be greatly improved on today. You know, this is the central challenge of our age, of the next decade, as our economy changes, as our society changes. If it's 22% of the global economy today, you know, and it's going to be 50% 10 or 15 years from now, you know, how do we think about, you know, the strategies, and how do we utilize, as we have for many of the seminal challenges in our society, how do we use the research universities around the country as part of the solution? We're very good at the basic research, and we work in collaboration with the other sectors in terms of basic research into applied research. And so some of the things that we think about is, how do we start to leverage the brilliant minds, not only in the cyber domains, but in the adjacent domains that allow us to look at applications in different ways that have been used in different industry examples brought here. I've had the opportunity to work in healthcare for the last 15 years. I've seen the information sharing, as an example, grow tremendously, as well as policy changes that have fostered more exchange of information. It's not always been good. Sometimes it's gone, you know, too far in one direction or the other, but it's pushed us to be more innovative, and it's pushed the needle in the right direction for the industry as a whole. And, you know, how do we think about those things from a standpoint of cybersecurity? We just had a tremendous travesty out here in the region, where our local NBA team lost the NBA finals, and who they were up against, you know, faced with the most offensive team in the NBA, not only played good defense, but they selectively played good offense. And is this game not just a game of defense, but is there ways to have counterattack strategies and offensive strategies against the perpetrators that maybe the research universities could be on the forefront of thinking through, given that we have some of the best minds to throw at problems like these? And then the third opportunity, I think, was mentioned earlier, it's in workforce development. We're in the business of teaching and learning and preparing the workforce for tomorrow and our citizens for tomorrow. And I think that the university systems need to be given a grand challenge to really help with the fact that we have 2 billion few cybersecurity professionals by 2019, according to ISACA. When you look at, especially the research universities, it's the opportunity to work alongside the faculty members, to work in a research setting plus workforce development that has really been a great formula that's worked for us as a nation in many, many different examples. And, you know, given that the cyber talent challenge is a long-term challenge, it's one I think our universities need to play a critical role in, and partnering with both state and federal government, we can at least make a dent in this particular challenge. So, you know, University of California, you know, we just see cyber risk and cybersecurity as the new norm. We've been here for California for over 150 years, really helping it with every major societal and economic change, from agrarian to industrial to informational to now the age that we find ourselves in. We continue to evolve as an organization as our state and our nation and the world needs us to. And as we see cyber risk as something that's here for the long haul, we're taking a long-term approach to this. It's a long-term game for us. We've continued to refine our approaches inside the organization, because we are an organization that has to have protection strategies, detection strategies, response strategies, social engineering strategies to help us understand the risks. But at the same time, we think playing the role of core research, whether it's to advance the space, to really help prepare the workforce of tomorrow, is a significant role that that we think that we can, should, working with private industry, working with the public sector, and we hope and look forward to comments and questions from you and how we might do that better. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. Next, we'll have Dr. Cynthia Dwork from Microsoft. Welcome. What are your comments?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored to have been invited to present to the commission. I'm going to focus on one topic, differential privacy. Differential privacy is a definition of privacy, together with a collection of supporting algorithmic techniques tailored to privacy-preserving statistical analysis of very large data sets. Differential privacy is a mathematical guarantee that an individual data contributor will not be affected adversely or otherwise by allowing her data to be used in any study or analysis, no matter what other studies, data sets, or information sources are available now or in the future. At their best, differentially private algorithms can make confidential data widely available for accurate data analysis without resorting to data clean rooms, data usage agreements, data protection plans, or restricted views. Nonetheless, data utility will eventually be consumed. The fundamental law of information recovery, which says that overly accurate estimates of too many statistics can completely destroy privacy, is a mathematical truth and can no more be circumvented than can the laws of physics. The goal of algorithmic research on differential privacy is to postpone this inevitability for as long as possible. Differential privacy measures and controls privacy loss accumulating over multiple analyses. This signal capability makes it possible to program in a differentially private fashion. In ordinary, non-private computation, anything that can be computed from multiplication and addition. But that is not how programmers work. Algorithm design is the creative combination of appropriate computational primitives to carry out a sophisticated computational task while minimizing the consumption of key resources such as time and space. Similarly, differentially private algorithm design is the creative combining of simple differentially private primitives to perform a sophisticated analytical task while also minimizing privacy loss and inaccuracy. As a rule, when the data set is large, the signal dominates the noise injected for privacy. When the data set is small, this is not the case. This is correct. Think of the case of a data set of size 1. To ensure privacy, the noise must dominate the signal. Differential privacy adopts a traditional cybersecurity mindset. Adversarial data analysts are assumed to be sophisticated cyber actors with access to large troves of side information easily accessed in a networked world, perhaps owned by the very companies or government agencies that employ the adversary, and that can be brought to bear to exploit vulnerabilities in a privacy-protected information system. Differentially private algorithms are future-proof even against such actors. Differential privacy is the wrong technique for finding a needle in a haystack or searching out the terrorist. Designed to preserve the privacy of everybody, even the needles, the goal is to solicit participation without fear of repercussion. Indeed, it is often the outliers who most need protection. Nonetheless, the techniques can have applications in the context of finding bad actors or patients zero. First, it can provide the means for learning normal or typical behavior patterns in a privacy-preserving fashion. In other words, it can be used to define the needles by contrasting them with normal. Second, the approach can be modified to distinguish between parties for whom privacy is explicitly protected and a targeted subgroup for whom it is not. Google uses differential privacy to identify dangerous websites that are popular among the users of Chrome. Apple will deploy differential privacy in iOS 10 for a variety of data analytics, such as learning new terms for quick type suggestions. The common factor in these two examples, one for cybersecurity and the other for a competitive user experience, is compliance with a strong non-technical privacy promise via adherence to a rigorous mathematical guarantee. I want to close with three policy recommendations. The first, publish your epsilons. Differentially private algorithms are equipped with a privacy parameter, usually called epsilon, capping their privacy loss. In a non-private algorithm, epsilon is infinite. By maintaining a registry of privacy loss akin to toxic release registries, we stimulate competition to obtain better analyses at lower privacy costs and we engage those who traffic in the data of individuals in the effort to protect the privacy of their subjects. Second, establish a list of approved private data analysis techniques and appropriate applications and keep it current. Third, consider restraint. In a data-rich world, the challenges revolve around the trade-off between what can be done and acceptance of the fundamental truth that overly accurate estimates of too many statistics can destroy privacy. If we are interested in privacy, sometimes restraint might be the right approach. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Eric Gross from Google. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Donilon and Commission members. I'm delighted to be here today to talk about this important topic of collaboration. We care a lot about that. My name is Eric Gross. I'm a Vice President of Security Engineering at Google. Over the past decade, I've built up a core team of over 500 experts in security and privacy, and I'm very proud of our having deployed more or less comprehensive network encryption, really changing the world there, having created consumer authentication systems that are actually usable and that we've observed can actually stop even the top-level actors from hijacking accounts, and done a variety of other things in malware analysis that enables us to do detection and attribution that I thought of as only Hollywood capabilities, but it's very impressive. So as you can tell, I'm very excited by the technology and recently stepped down from running that whole team to work directly on trying to harden open source software to bring it to these same levels of capability. Today, I'd like to talk about two themes that undergird important advances and I think are related to the technology, but closer to the policy implications that go into that transition memo that you're working on. So we all agree a safe internet's essential for everyone, and we've seen how it's changed. When I started, we had a few dozen machines that completely trusted each other sitting behind a firewall that kept the bad guys out. Now we see 3 million smartphones added per day on a network that can't be trusted, with very complicated trust relationships and threats that are evolving rapidly as well. So at Google, we believe it's important to keep not only our own users and our systems protected from all of these threats, but we also try to use our resources to collaborate with others in ways that we hope can help all of the internet's users. So I'd like to talk about a couple of important collaborations. First, on vulnerability reporting. We've tried to lead a discussion over the past years, and there's been a big evolution in the practice of someone who finds a vulnerability, reporting it to the people who can fix it in the right manner so that it can be fixed and that fix can be deployed to minimize the harm to users. This is a very challenging problem. We really are looking for a way to get the word out without causing harm. And we're prepared to spend significant monetary resources. As Alex was saying earlier, these bug bounty programs involve spending millions of dollars. Actually, the internal resources we spend to run those programs is larger than those checks we're writing. It takes a lot of skilled engineers to process these incoming reports. So we do a lot of that. We also invest in doing the security research ourselves, looking for vulnerabilities, of course, in our own products, the things that we write. That's routine. That's a standard product security role. We also invest some of these security resources in looking at vulnerabilities in other software, open source and even proprietary source from our colleagues and competitors in the space. And then we carefully report those vulnerabilities to them, give them a chance to fix it before we then go public. We think it's important that this disclosure process to those vendors and their repair process happen promptly. Time is of the essence here, and that's the other big improvement I've seen over the last few years, the acceleration of the time scale. Now, governments also have researchers that uncover vulnerabilities. And in the U.S., there's a process through which these vulnerabilities are reviewed and recommendations are made on how to handle them. At the beginning of 2014, the President's Review Group on Intelligence and Communication Technologies made a recommendation, and President Obama pledged that indeed the government would rebalance its assessment favoring disclosure of zero-day vulnerabilities to vendors. And I applaud that. There are, of course, some exceptions that are made for national security and law enforcement purposes. So I've been watching, since that announcement, I've been watching what's been happening and trying to understand how that government effort compares, say, with what I could see happening at Google. And frankly, it's, I wish it were easier to assess. Collaboration, as you all know, requires an accumulation of trust built over time. And I think the government's missing an opportunity here. As an example, the kind of thing I admire, I remember some years ago when Android first came out, the Information Assurance Directorate, under your leadership, General, came to Google and privately told us about some problems inside Android, and we fixed those. That was exactly the kind of relationship I'd like to see. I imagine more of that is happening under the president's recommendation to rebalance, but I don't hear of it happening. I don't hear it, don't see it at Google, and I don't hear about it from my friends at the other companies. So if you're doing it, I would strongly urge you to take public credit for it. I think that will help repair some of the trust deficit that poisons the atmosphere today. Another topic in public-private collaboration often is threat sharing, and we heard some discussion already this morning about sharing of IOCs and other threat indicators, and that is certainly useful. We'd like to see that. In addition to that kind of, here's an IP address you should worry about if one of your corporate machines has visited that site, in addition to that, what I've seen helpful in the private threat sharing that Google has found most useful in defending against attacks is not just these small threat indicators, but a greater understanding of the full context of the attack. Who's coming at us, in what way, what are they going after, what's the sequence of the events, and so forth. And the best example I can think of in my recent memory of the government helping in that was Rob Joyce's talk at the Enigma conference, where he's the head of the tailored access operations, and he basically said, I've got a very good team. Their mission is to break in various places. If you want to be able to defend against a team of that sort, here's what you have to do. I recommend that videotape to everybody that I'm talking to who's new in this business. That kind of advice goes beyond just threat indicators, very helpful. In addition to sharing these kinds of signals, there's another aspect of collaboration that I'd like to emphasize, transparency. And it's a very important topic. But I have several examples in the written testimony, but in the interest of time, let me just skip to one. Beginning in 2010, Google launched the Transparency Report, which provided details about aggregate details about the requests to Google from various governments around the world to remove or disclose user data. And I think that transparency report, which has now been emulated by other companies, is very healthy at giving people an understanding of what's actually happening, because sometimes this is played out in the shadows, and when things are happening in the shadows, some people are oblivious and then make the wrong risk decisions, and some people over-exaggerate what the risks to them are. So I think it's very helpful to have greater transparency here. There's still a long way to go. It's helpful that we can give these aggregate numbers of FISA and national security letters and so forth, but I would really like to see more. In this vein, Google has also worked to be able to tell particular users when the government has made requests for their data. Now, there are times when we're gagged from doing so, and in some of these cases, it's easy to understand why. You don't tip off a legal investigation of a criminal who's a flight risk, obviously. But systemic indiscriminate and perpetual use of gag orders is corrosive of trust over time. Providers should be silenced from telling users about requests only when there's truly a need to do so, and not forever. So, and I would also urge the government to be more transparent to those users. It shouldn't only fall to the companies to do that. So, in the long run, I think this will bring greater legitimacy to the laws and build more confidence in the system. So, those are a couple of the principles of collaboration and transparency that I believe are very important for the next administration to consider, and I hope that's helpful to you. And I'm happy to take more questions.
Eric, thank you. I'm sure we'll come back to a number of those points. Eli Sugarman from Hewlett-Packard, welcome, and look forward to your statement.
Great. Thank you for inviting me today to address the commission. It's a privilege to do so, especially on the campus of UC Berkeley, a longstanding Hewlett Foundation partner, and in conjunction with the Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity, one of our anchor grantees. I'll focus my remarks today on the role of philanthropy in supporting collaboration on cybersecurity between government, private sector, and other key actors. First, a few words of context. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation is a private charitable foundation based across the bay in Menlo Park. Over the past 50 years, we've served the public interest by making a little over $5.5 billion in grants on complex policy issues ranging from education to climate change to cybersecurity. 2 years ago, we launched our cyber initiative, which is a five-year, $65 million grant-making effort that tries to build a more capable cyber policy field that can offer solutions to some of the complex problems that we're discussing today. Our views are premised on the firm belief that technology alone will not solve the cybersecurity challenges that are confronting the United States and the world at large. As the controversy and public debate over encryption highlights, we need smart policy to frame critical choices and manage institutions, networks, and behaviors that operate in cyberspace. Such policy frameworks do more than just help resolve the crises of the moment. They plan for the future. They must, as such, look forward and identify where the road is going that we're on, and not just look at the present or at the past. So despite the urgent need for these cybersecurity policy frameworks, the universities, the think tanks, and the nonprofits that would do a lot of that thinking are actually pretty starved for resources. One might normally look to the government, in this case, the U.S. government, to fill the gap. But in this case, it may be difficult. Not only is congressional appropriations complicated in this particularly fraught political environment, but there are also two other reasons where the government probably isn't the solution here, but is a partner. First, government is focused largely on the day-to-day crises, protecting the nation, protecting certain classes of enterprises. And that makes sense because the government clearly has a role to play there. Senior officials oftentimes want to play a longer-term, more strategic role, but oftentimes can't, given the pressing demands of their positions, as I think many on the commission know even better than I. Second, the government admittedly faces a trust deficit with certain tech companies, certain stakeholders, both located here in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. And that lack of trust makes it difficult for the government to be the sole funder of certain types of policy research. Because if certain frameworks and ideas were to be generated solely funded by the government, certain people would question those ideas and call into question those frameworks, thereby minimizing their real impact. Companies, meanwhile, are obviously animated by profit generally and commercial imperative, as is expected. Some do try to maximize and serve the public interest, but obviously are limited in doing so because they're companies. And so the private sector does fund some work on the broader cyber policy issue set, but oftentimes it is linked to some degree to government relations and other commercial imperatives. Meanwhile, internet and technology entrepreneurs are largely absent from this funding landscape, which is a little surprising. If you think back to an earlier era, individuals such as Andrew Carnegie or John D. Rockefeller spent large sums, dedicated the bulk of their assets, which they gained during industrialization, to serve the public interest and try to mitigate the disruption caused to U.S. society by virtue of the industrialization that they benefited from financially. Today, unfortunately, few leading innovators and entrepreneurs are doing something similar and investing in a secure, stable, resilient internet from which they have built quite viable companies and technologies. One other example that's worth noting here to sort of crystallize what we're talking about in terms of philanthropies and foundations. Most people have forgotten, but foundations have actually played a critical role in shoring up U.S. national security in the past. One particular example is Alfred Lee Loomis, who during World War II individually financed a lot of the leading research into radar, which was then rapidly deployed and actually was one of the critical technologies that helped allies prevail. So this little quick snapshot basically just points to the fact that there's an alarming gap in our ability to deal with cybersecurity challenges, in part because we don't have the right policy frameworks. The private sector is trying, the government is trying, but we believe strongly there's a big role for foundations, philanthropists, and other donors to step in and collaborate. Many foundations know about this and the importance of cybersecurity, but are a little scared and uncertain about how to contribute and what to do and how to think about these issues. A handful of them have dipped their toes into the water, focusing more on human rights and civil liberties issues. Others focus clearly just on a little snapshot of the national security perspective. The Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative, however, is the largest dedicated foundation effort on cyber. And that's a little alarming given the size of the need. I mean, we firmly believe that an order of magnitude or more funding is needed on cyber policy issues. Let me conclude by offering a few concrete suggestions. First, the Commission is uniquely positioned, directly and then indirectly by virtue of its recommendations, to help the government engage philanthropic funders, to really make clear to them how acute the need is, the role they can play, share information with them so that they really understand the risks, and really help them identify how and with whom to collaborate. So I think that's one critical area, and I commend the Commission on being open to that. I think that's one area that very few government entities have thought about or actively engaged in. Second, I would encourage the Commission to call upon the government to think more creatively about how to engage with civil society. Given some of the examples that Eric and others have cited where nonprofits, individual researchers, and others are key actors in the ecosystem, I think that engaging civil society in such a way that builds trust and encourages collaborative research and effort is needed, and it may be a little bit outside of the comfort zone of government, and it may be slightly outside of their traditional toolbox, but it's worth exploring. Third, just to echo the calls for additional transparency, I think that we, of course, understand why law enforcement and the intelligence community largely are slow to be transparent and open because of a lot of what they do is very sensitive, and that makes sense. I would commend General Alexander's organization on some of the steps it's taken recently, but I think more is still needed in terms of being open and transparent and welcoming in outside experts, whether funders or academics or others, to have the conversation to just dig deeper into the issues, much in the way that we're doing here today. And then fourth and finally, I do think there's something the government can do more specifically on funding, which is to really give a mandate to the National Science Foundation and other government funding vehicles to focus on multidisciplinary cyber policy research, to really make it clear that bringing together the technical disciplines with the social sciences and humanities is critical. You can't just have technical solutions. You can't just focus on the social sciences. Rather, you need to bring them together. And I think that given the way that certain government funding is structured, that's unnecessarily difficult, and that's another example of low-hanging fruit for the Commission to think about how can you bring those two funding streams together. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eli. I apologize. I think at the outset I said Hewlett Packard,
not at all. I get it
Foundation.
A lot.
Why don't we start then with Joe?
Thank you. A differential privacy really excites me. I don't know if a lot of people say that, but I think they don't yet say that because they don't understand it. And I probably don't really understand it either. But the reason it excites me is because I see a world right now where, there was the quote a while back that every company is becoming a software company. It feels like right now every company is becoming a data company. Every company is gathering and storing more and more data about their customers to develop insights to target them for ads or to remarket to them or for whatever reason. And so we're seeing more and more situations around the world where companies are aggregating large data sets about people. And that leads to two different things. One is a large percentage of the people inside the organization are accessing that data directly in its raw form. And it's really hard for companies to do good institutional security around who has access, is it an authorized purpose, for, et cetera. But then the second part is governments come along and want to have access to that information as well once it's been accumulated. And so, one of the solutions we talk about is, and we've seen in the messaging context a lot of debate about encryption and things like that. But in the absence of that, in a context where companies want to have the data because it can add value to the products, it seems like there should be a role for differential privacy getting standardized and adopted broadly in terms of how companies are storing, ultimately storing the data in ways that will be, or translating the data and then storing it in ways that they can use it, but that is privacy protecting for the consumer. Could you talk to that a little bit more?
So first and foremost, it's a tool for statistical analysis. And so it's not necessarily the right tool for storing information that lets you treat different of your users in a different fashion and personalize. What the kinds of things that it can do for you in personalization is ensure that the information of one person is not affecting how other people are treated. So think about a movie recommendation system. If I'm going to recommend movies to you, I can have those recommendations appropriately reflect your tastes. After all, there's no need to keep privacy from you about the movies that you like. But the recommendations that I make to you, having run some sophisticated recommendation systems, somehow shouldn't be very influenced by Herb Lin's preferences. That would be a spilling, an inappropriate spilling of information. Those are the kinds of things that differential privacy can help with. It's also the case that the approaches that Google and Apple are using involve injecting differential privacy actually into the data themselves before they are collected. Right. And so, no matter how much anybody investigates those now modified data, it will be impossible to learn anything about the individual who provided those randomized data. There are also techniques that involve processing data and then destroying it and maintaining some sort of local state of information that has measured statistical properties without actually keeping raw data around. Does this help at all?
It is. Where do you see it developing next and potentially becoming something that's adopted at more than just a couple of kind of leading companies?
There are several projects for trying to take a particular collection of usage scenarios that share a common theme, like statistical analysis of social research data, for example, and developing libraries for carrying out the kinds of analyses that people are doing in that field. And I'm thinking in particular of a project at Harvard that's doing exactly this, and they work also computer scientists and statisticians and legal experts and social scientists. So I can envision a long-term real library being built up of a bunch of different units that are designed for different sorts of scenarios or settings.
Do you think that it, so one of the things I've seen, I've been in a number of different tech companies, and we've had challenges where we've wanted to collaborate with academics, but we didn't want to open up the data that we had because of the privacy constraints that we'd imposed on ourselves in our privacy commitments to the people we served. And so there was frequently a I went to like 12 years ago, maybe, I went to an FTC event on online auctions, and a number of academics were speaking about, and they had all scraped eBay, which was my employer at the time. And I noticed that most of the data was flawed because they had not gotten the data directly from us, but they were doing a bunch of research that was also ultimately flawed because they had been broadly scraping and not understood the nuances of what they were doing or gotten all of the data they needed. And I just thought, I still remember that day thinking, wow, if we had given them the right data, this would have been a really valuable conference. And because the power of academia would have been unleashed on thinking about online auctions, and we never got to that place.
So that would be a perfect setting for differential privacy, because you could make the data available in a differentially private fashion, and you would know that it was actually correct data. And when I spoke about libraries being constructed of various units that were topic specific, so there would be one that would be presumably appropriate to the kind of computations that people who study auctions are interested in carrying out.
Right. Okay, great. I have a couple other questions on other topics, but if I don't know if you should I just go through my questions? Okay. Eric, you mentioned that you spend a lot of your time now working on hardening open source, and I think we've seen a lot of really interesting work and investment through things like the, I don't know, whether the Linux Foundation efforts or what you've been doing at Google. What role do you see the government playing in kind of getting involved and helping push this work forward?
Well, one way that we Google as a whole try to help in this open source world is we extended our bug bounty program to open source. And not in the obvious way. The natural thing would be to say, well, we send you a check for $5,000 if you report a real vulnerability. My sense was open source is done by volunteers, and it's unfair to put that kind of a timely fixed burden on the volunteers. So we restructured our bug bounty program a little bit in that area to say, actually, we send what we encourage is for you to find the problem, find the fix, send the fix upstream, and once it's committed, we'll send you a reward for that, you know, sort of so forth. I think that program has not taken off as far as I would like it to. Again, open source is done by volunteers, so it's a persuasion kind of a thing, and I guess we weren't persuasive enough yet. But that's a thing that government could just as easily have been funding, because all of us are using open source widely in our systems, including the government. So that would be one concrete thing the government could do. Put more money and attention into programs like that. That would be helpful. But I think it's also true that, as I was saying, the government has people who have unique understanding of where the vulnerabilities in the world are. Some of those they need to keep for themselves, but to the extent that they can share that understanding with people in a position to fix it, I think that would be very useful. So I'm encouraging the vulnerability reporting not only to official software vendors, but also to the open source community that is responsible for fixing these problems.
One last question, Eric, on a different topic is, one of the things when I looked at our mandate as a commission was to focus on defense, and I was excited about that. And then the kind of the DNC stories from the last week reminded me that there are frequently situations where nation state related conflicts spill over into private systems. And so it raised again for me the question of, like, what is the role of government in coming in and helping, like, what should the government be doing to help secure private systems? You know, during the last panel, we talked about, like, whether you are or not critical infrastructure seems to be part of that. But, you know, to a certain extent, the entire digital economy is critical infrastructure, and that's just semantics. So, like, what is the role, what should the role of government be in helping private enterprise have a minimum standard of security?
Okay, so a couple interesting points there. I frankly have modest expectations about how much the U.S. government should do to raise the security of the private sector. It's a huge problem, and the best that the government could do is set a better example itself, and that doesn't require a lot of collaboration. It doesn't involve any risk of the companies feeling overregulated or something. If the government just sets a really good example and then talks about that good example, that's healthy, number one. But number two, I would say I really think it is not the role of the private sector to go on offense. This hack back stuff is a bad idea. Vigilantes over the years have caused a lot more harm than good. So I'm not keen on seeing offense migrate outside of the government. That's the government's role, and it should stay there. On the other hand, you can't have an effective defense if you don't play offense against yourself. And so we routinely run red team exercises against ourselves to see where, not so much where the vulnerabilities, because we're already doing that as a matter of product security, but how effective are we at catching an intruder and responding to it? Because sometimes I've seen companies that caught something, they saw something was anomalous, but they just relax about following up in a rigorous way. So playing offense against yourself is definitely a good idea. But your defense can get trained against your own offense. So here's a place where, excuse me, we could go further and play some offense games against each other. It could be company against company. I've even suggested in the past, company against government. These red teams, of course, have to run under supervision. You don't just let people loose. But you do actually give some engineers the charge, okay, your job for the next week is to try to break into Google, and you get to use anything you can think of, no rules, no holds barred. But you're going to be doing it under observation of a referee, and as soon as you get to some root access or something, we call timeout and say, okay, you won the exercise. These kinds of practice offense are really valuable, and I think it's not used enough across the board. So I would encourage that. But there's also an obligation if you're going to do that. It's important that you commit the resources to follow up on the results of those exercises. What I've heard from red teams in the government is they've got some very good red teams. The red team wins, as expected, but then the defense gets this report and doesn't do anything with it. So the red team comes back 3 years later, and the same thing that worked the last time works this time. That's really the problem. So I hope that's a helpful answer on the roles in the private sector of defense and offense.
That was helpful. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks to the panel. It was very informative, I know, for all of us. So, Thomas, I wanted to kind of ask Thomas and Eli kind of bookend questions on collaboration. So you are involved with one of the largest education systems in the world, and you also have this other feeder education system called the community colleges system here in California. And you're also sort of in the heartbeat of technology and innovation all around you, especially here on this campus. Are there specific things that you could be doing with the two school systems to really drive workforce development in this area? Because we do have a shortage of workforce, especially with retraining. And are there policy incentives that the government could put in place, whether it's a state level or a federal level, that could help incent you to do more of that?
So the answer would be yes. We're just starting to talk about it. We should be, and yes, we could use more policy incentives, you know, from either state or federal government to help us do that. I think when you look at the combined population of the three segments, let's not leave out the California state system, with its 23 campuses.
Right.
You know, we've got roughly 2.5 million, you know, students again, come from all different backgrounds, not just 18 to 22-year-olds, and the opportunity to, you know, create, you know, awareness and an evolving workforce to help address this challenge. You know, I'm in some conversations right now really trying to bring this to the forefront, just with starting with our campuses. And a lot of times what we see our role here in California is that we start the conversation and then we invite our sister systems into to then include and expand upon what we do. But having policy frameworks to help us with this, incentive, dedicated programs would definitely be of help.
It would be also interesting if for transfers into the UC system from the community colleges, there were some requirements for a computer science degree or network engineering degrees, mm-hmm. that they could take some cyber classes before they even get to the campus.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be degree. I mean, there also can be certificate-based programs, right. that get people into early career positions around cyber, that if you go out and you look at the openings, and they are very well paid, even at a 1-2 year experience level. And that should also be a part of the workforce development program.
Absolutely. Thank you. And Eli, just very quickly, I found it very interesting, the whole concept of, you know, philanthropy funders as a mechanism to help in this whole area. Have you thought at all about the extension of the foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, reaching out to other foundations to work collectively? And is there some policy that could be done, or, you know, an accelerator from the government perspective to help encourage that?
It's a great idea, and it's something that we're actively engaged in. And so we are working with other foundations to engage with them, to try to show them both the salience of these issues, but then also concrete opportunities where you can make a difference by, for example, funding educational programs at UC Berkeley to try to help fill gaps in the workforce, depending on sort of where in the pyramid you're trying to address that need. And so we are actively doing that. We're also, you know, talking to others in Washington about how you can leverage different, I guess, messaging platforms and pulpits, if you will, to call upon philanthropies, with us sort of being one of the voices to call upon them, saying, you know, we're doing this, this is the impact we think we're achieving, but we really need additional resources. So we're trying to. And I mean, one of the challenges is that every major foundation, like, you know, a major company or a major, you know, government entity, has good reasons for funding what it's funding and doing what it's doing the way it's doing it now. And so trying to find the way to frame and to make a convincing argument takes time and requires just getting to know the individual institutions, because no one size fits all. It's very individualized, but we're actively trying to do that. And there are a few instances where we've been able to bring in other funders to partner on different grants to specific grantees. And so we're definitely thinking about how to scale that and how you can find those partners.
Right. And anything else that the government could do from a tax incentive perspective?
Yeah. I mean, from a tax incentive perspective, I think it's highlighting, you know, highlighting this and making a public call or a call to action. And in the past, the White House and other individuals in senior positions have highlighted policy challenges that are a national imperative and called upon everybody in society and singled out foundations to say, we need your help and your resources to solve this problem. I think that's one way. I think a second way is helping to educate funders, because a lot of these, you know, these are complex technical issues that we've been talking about. And I think that for a foundation or a funder who's used to funding on a completely different issue area, they're daunted by the complexity. So just sharing information, it's another form of information sharing, and briefing and being very open to explain, these are concrete problems and this is the type of research or education or other effort that you could specifically fund that would be helpful. So I think education is also very important. And then I think that just, you know, brokering relationships, if there are pre-existing relationships with individuals or with certain companies or high net worth individuals who serve on advisory panels or whatever their role may be, trying to look at where those relationships are and then where you can bring those to bear, again, to just bring in foundations, teach them, and make them feel more comfortable.
Thank you.
Thanks for pointing out that NSA had done something good. I recorded that. I think I'm as stunned as the rest of the people. Thanks. I have a series of questions. Actually, I'm going to drive to one. Alex Stamos talked about Facebook having 1.65 billion users. And as you think about that, our country has about 300 million people, which means 80% of his company is outside the United States. Yet the discussion that we principally have about collaboration is as a U.S. entity to a U.S. entity, when it seems that what we really need to set is how does the United States help engage an international set of engagements on how we share here and abroad for companies who are global. My thought, and this is where the question comes in, is that we can start the discussion here, but our government and our industry has to work together to help set this framework. I'm interested in your thoughts about how we should actually go about doing that nationally and then internationally to help solve this problem that increasingly has become more difficult for our commercial entities and our government working abroad. Any thoughts?
Well, thank you very much for making that point, because I feared a little bit coming here. I thought, oh, another Washington thing. Washington's always so U.S.-centric, and so I'm really glad you raised that point. When we talk about collaborating with governments, we often have to remind everyone involved that we do have more than half of our users outside the United States, and we owe it to them to show that we're even-handed. So we're looking for collaborations on a basis where everyone who's willing to play by this set of rules has a seat at the table. It's not, oh, well, you happen to have a headquarters domiciled in a certain state, and therefore you're totally under the thumb of this one government. So I think this is a really important point. And the U.S. government, fortunately, has a lot of relationships with other countries around the world, and so should be in a better position than companies typically are to figure out what are the right ways to structure things so that there's going to be some recognition of legitimacy of people from around the world. There are naturally sovereignty issues, and so it's also tricky for us because we may not even understand exactly what the sensitivities are for each government. They're not always transparent about what they're really worried about. They'll say what they're worried about, but it's hard sometimes to understand. So I'm tremendously valuable point. I'm really glad to hear that. We've tried to help with MLAT reform. This is one of the hot items. Obviously, when we talk about public-private relationships, law enforcement is often one of the places where it gets to be the hottest issue. And if you think it's difficult for U.S. law enforcement to get access to everything they want on the timescale they want, I mean, you just have to talk to law enforcement outside the U.S. and the process they have to go through. So that's certainly an area that I know Google has tried to come to Washington, help. Can we do something to improve the MLAT process? And there's been a little bit of improvement in recent years, but more would be better. But to go beyond just law enforcement relationships to the broad set of topics for security, yes, I think that's a tremendously important topic.
So just to take that one point further, it seems to me, in my experience in dealing with other nations on this topic, everybody has a different standard for what's private. Some countries say an IP address, for example, is private. But if you want to share the IP address that's attacking you, you run into an issue. So perhaps if we were to step back and raise that up a level, what we're really saying is to come up with a standard that describes what can and should be shared between government and industry, governments and industries, national and international, and either prescribe a path to generate such a working group or help move that along. It seems to me, as we're looking at this set of issues, that NATO's recent declaration about cyber being an operational domain presupposes that everybody has the same definition of what we're going to do in that. And that in and of itself is not true. So our government can't do this without industry support. Our government shouldn't do this without working internationally. And so I think the real issue that we have to break through is how does government and industry start this discussion in a more reasoned way to help move it forward. And I think with the best intentions in mind. So, you know, things that you don't have to answer here, but are things that I think we should pull out so that we get that moving along. Does that make sense?
Makes very good sense, and we look forward to that kind of collaboration. Yes.
Yeah, if I could add, you know, somehow around the world we came to have an internet that's truly global, right? What examples can we learn going back and thinking about how that evolved? The second thought in listening to your question is, it seems to me it would make the most sense to frame the need around the economic growth around the world rather than let it evolve into something just be about privacy or just be about national defense interests. But if we focused it on economic growth, we'd get more people into the conversation and more of the right direction rather than more splitting of, I need to make sure I protect the way that we look at this particular challenge.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it brings up another piece of this that I think needs to be put on the table. And that is, in some countries, I won't name any, but you probably have greater insights. At times it appears to me, I'm coming out of government, so I don't have the commercial sector experience that all of you have. But at times it seems like it's a protectionist move versus a civil liberties and privacy move. We've got to level that playing field by setting this framework up correctly to do it. And if I could, one other issue, because you gave some great insights on the healthcare industry. And I know the biggest threats that we see this year coming against the healthcare industry is ransomware and what's going on with that. What are your thoughts on what we can and should be doing to help solve that problem as well?
At a governmental level? Boy, you know, at a governmental level, I'm not sure there's anything. I mean, you know, as we've talked about it amongst our, you know, five academic medical centers, seeing some of, you know, our peers around the country struggle with this, you know, it's much more about our internal conversation about how serious we about the threats today, and it's a term that gets used at many of our campuses, the balancing test. The balancing test of protecting information versus how much we invest, how much we're willing to invest, you know, to protect the information and the financial and institutional risk. I can't think of anything off the top of my head that government could do to help with the ransomware problem, because it's really is very, as we're experiencing, very local. Do we know where our valuable data assets are? What have we done in our environment to be able to detect activity that might affect them, protect them? And then what are our strategies if it does get ransomed, that we are in a position that we can recover from it? So off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that government should be doing beyond what we have today. But it is a serious issue.
And if General Alexander, just to go back to one of your earlier questions about an international multi-stakeholder approach to MLAT, data requests, privacy standards, and the like, I think that there are one or two research efforts underway that I think are promising that directly get to your question. One of them is called the Internet and Jurisdiction Project. And this is an international nonprofit based in Paris that is trying to bring together the main corporate stakeholders, the governments from Europe, from the US, from the developing world, and is sponsored by some companies, including, I believe, Google and a few others are funding it. And the idea is to try to identify where are the use cases where you can align different standards in different ways to share different kinds of information between government and companies based upon their respective requirements under their constitutions and laws. And so it's a very nascent effort, but I think it's very complementary to some of the great academic research also happening that Peter Swire at Georgia Tech is doing, that really tries to look at not only from an American perspective, but looking at, say, India, which came up in Alex's comments earlier as sort of a key player here. How do you align India's democratic standards and its growing technology industry, plus the fact that it's a huge marketplace for all the major companies, in a way that also satisfies basic U.S. needs and standards. And I think that coming at it from the global perspective, like you're highlighting, is absolutely critical.
Thank you. And thank you all for your comments. I think that you have definitely identified the desire that we all have for collaboration and also the unique power that a multidisciplinary approach could take to solving some of these problems. And also the role, the unique role that research universities and the university affiliated research centers can play in convening all these different parties, the federal government, the private sector, and philanthropy. So I have two questions on the heels of this. One is, what do you see as the barriers for being able to expand some of the good models that we have for the collaborative effort in research and development in these areas? And I go to Joe's point about privacy being one of the concerns and potentially one of the barriers to be able to allow for collaboration. The other things that I've observed include concerns about intellectual property rights, or also simply conflicts of interest that may exist when you have multiple parties working on the same kind of answer. And then also looking at research and development more broadly, meaning not technical solutions, but looking into other fields for possible solutions, for example, public health or social policy or policy in general. And how do you identify examples of good work in those fields that could be applied to solving the problem but are not necessarily technological R&D?
So I think it's a great question. And based upon what I've seen at the foundation, when we're looking at universities and who do we fund and why, and what are some of the barriers to their success, privacy, of course, is one. I think that good data, whether it's not shared because of privacy issues, because of commercial advantage, because of classification, I think there are many reasons why good data is not available to academic researchers who are trying to analyze it and then connect it to policy frameworks. So I think that those are different problems. I think the reps from the companies can better explain how you may find ways to unlock that information. I think from the government, I think you've started to see more openness and a desirability to reach out and to say, we know that we're the only ones who have certain information. Is there a way where we can talk about it or provide it at a certain level that then can be broadly used for research that doesn't then stay classified itself? But it's an ongoing challenge. I think that as far as how do you find examples from other disciplines and domains and policy areas that are relevant, I think it's great, and it's an ongoing challenge, and it really requires academics to consciously try to seek out friends and experts and look outside their discipline, which is somewhat counterintuitive sometimes for academic disciplines, where your career progression is generally relying upon you excelling in that single discipline, and that attempts to bridge disciplines are oftentimes shunned and looked down upon. And I think that one of the ways we're trying to overcome that is only funding efforts where there is a conscious effort to go outside a single discipline, bring together the social sciences and the technical disciplines. It's unfortunately at this point, it's really individualized to single researchers who are going to take a broader, more expansive approach and look at public health to see if maybe a cyber CDC is a good example or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, I would say that I believe research universities are getting much better at multidisciplinary research. It's being pushed by the philanthropic community. We see more out of the federal funding agencies where they're looking for, and they're more interested in topics that are multidisciplinary in nature. So the trend for us is we have to become better at it. I see examples on many of our campuses where multidisciplinary is now considered, how you get ahead. There is kind of this domain, but the big societal problems are driven through multidisciplinary initiatives. So I think if we had more sponsored research to accommodate earlier, where it really, the requirement was that we look across domains, or that we take starting points with examples from other industries. Yeah, I know that in my own work, I'm constantly looking at trying to take things out of financial services and healthcare and drop them into, a topic like cyber. I know that universities sometimes, smart manufacturing, great example, plays a great role as an honest broker to get industry competitors to work together, because we can play the role of being an honest broker because we don't have a horse in the race per se. So I think multidisciplinary is part of what we need to be looking at more. I think the funding agencies recognizing that and making that more of a requirement for money for the future is going to be key.
So not to keep repeating the same point, but you talked about, Eli, you talked about ways to unlock data. Privacy preserving technology for data analysis is exactly what that's all about. So when we're talking about what role the government could play, well, clearly investing more research in building the tools and also investing in educating people, not only to develop the technology, but also to use the technology. People who have experience analyzing data have a set of methods that they use and procedures that they follow. And when you say to them, okay, now you have to interact with not raw data, but you have to interact with the data through a privacy-preserving interface, it can be very challenging and disconcerting. We do see a fair amount of movement in the statistics community toward embracing these technologies, but it's slow. And so people need to be educated how to use it as well as how to build it.
And just to sort of pick up on one more point, I think that it's fair that multidisciplinary research is becoming more popular and more mainstreamed. However, I think it largely remains a luxury of mid-career and more senior faculty members. And that for junior faculty members, PhD students, and postdocs, it's really difficult to engage in multidisciplinary research because there's no job for you. There are very few, if any, junior faculty jobs at any leading research university that lets you do multidisciplinary research on cybersecurity. There may be one or two I'm not aware of, but very, very rare. Where do you publish your multidisciplinary research? There are now two multidisciplinary cyber journals at Oxford and Chatham House, both started in the last, year. Again, they're not well known yet because they're brand new, but I think that it's definitely worth highlighting that where the government and others can intervene is, I think, particularly bridging the gap between the up-and-coming emerging experts and getting them into a career trajectory so that they can move up the ladder and then become the ultimate department chairs or heads of center who can then really ensure that multidisciplinary research is inculcated from day one.
Thank you. You raised some really interesting points on trying to solve this problem. And I would just say that it may be worth exploring the reframing of the issue, because I think that if you can reframe it a little bit to incorporate the human element of this more effectively, that the philanthropic community, and I think that the messaging from your development folks to people that can participate in funding would start to expand dramatically, and you might see more interest from that part of the potential funding universe. Thanks.
Just a quick question. We've been talking about collaboration, and I've been listening to the areas of collaboration you have identified in research, policy, threat mitigation, detection. I'm wondering, do you think we've forgotten any areas of potential collaboration? In particular, I'm thinking, it's interesting, I haven't heard anything about response and recovery, and that's usually a very broad area of collaboration. Is there a Red Cross for cyber event kind of opportunity that we're missing?
So one area in the private data analysis setting that comes up is, as I keep making this point, that eventually you have to stop using the data or reduce its utility. So collaboration in deciding what are the questions that you want to investigate in this data so that as many people can get as much benefit from it as possible before the sort of privacy budget runs out would be called for.
The tricky thing for the government to consider when it comes to collaboration on incident response is there's a perception in the private sector that if you bring in the government, or the government may insist on coming in, of course, that is mostly adding collateral damage on top of what you're already struggling to deal with. And so I think the problem right now for the government to participate more there would be getting rid of some of that history. And so in the aviation area, of course, it's well known that that works well. There are good safety reporting systems that don't cause that collateral damage to the person making the report. It's treated as
okay, let's take some of this information we're learning about bad stuff happening out there, and instead of immediately trying to point the finger of blame and assign some additional punishment, let's look across all of this, all these reports, and see what could we change in the world so that those things weren't happening so much. So if there could be some equivalent of that kind of safety reporting system in the cyber world, I think we all feel that would be a good idea. When in previous workshops we've talked about that typically foundered because many of these incidents wind up having some classified component, and so it was hard to find a place in the government that was that had both the clearances and the trust of all the stakeholders to play that role. So I don't have, that wasn't one of the recommendations I was making, because we have looked at that and not found a good way to go forward on in the past.
I was just going to make one. I don't know if it's an area, but the word collaboration has been thrown out a lot over the course of the morning. And I know that when our community here inside of University of California, we talk about collaboration, I usually bring up two terms together. One is trust. The other is interdependency. Because we can trust each other, but if we have nothing in common, if we don't have a shared goal or objective, collaboration doesn't need to happen. And so to what extent the commission could think about whether it's in the policy framework or in the incentive programs or in the direction of funding, create the interdependency that we need around some of these issues, take detection and response. If there's more interdependency for us to work together and then the incentives are there, that it will make more sense for us to do it. Trust plus interdependency usually leads to better collaboration in a very broad context.
So thank you all for coming today and sharing your very wise thoughts. We really appreciate it. One of the things that that I think universities in particular are struggling with is just how incredibly open a university network is. And the thousands of faculty, researchers, for example, who use the network in a variety of ways without them ever having been taught what's actually correct in terms of privacy and security. And then I also think about the number of empirical studies that are taking place on campuses where they receive IRB approvals without any real understanding of what it means to secure the data or what it means to preserve the privacy of sensitive data. I'm not sure where those conversations need to take place. And so, you have a huge university system. I know there are organizations like EDUCAUSE. I don't know if these kinds of conversations are taking place there or not, but I'm curious what you all think in terms of where should those conversations be happening? Companies do empirical studies. They have IRBs. Are there a set of best practices that should be shared across the board nationally with respect to this kind of sensitive information?
I don't have experience with the APRB, but I do remember when firewalls were first coming in and universities could not use firewalls because they needed to do research that, you know, the graduate student needed to have his machine directly on the internet so he could do the experiment. Fortunately, we've moved past that as a problem in my perspective. We now assume all our networks are compromised and malicious, even behind the firewall. And so I don't see as big a gap now between the companies and the universities as existed 10 or 15 years ago. Literally, we assume, even, you know, when you come into Google Office and you plug into the wall, you don't get access to anything. It's just essentially like plugging to the internet anywhere in a coffee shop. So we don't see the problem that we used to see. That is to say, we've given up trying to solve the security problem at the network level, and we say, no, each endpoint has to defend itself from a hostile network. And that means actually the university can pretty much run their operation in the same kind of security level as we are if they want.
I'm not sure that I find that at all comforting, actually. I think I'm getting more like just what's an ethical practice and what's the how, if we expect our universities to be training the future workforce of America and the people who are doing research at our basic universities don't know how to protect information or don't even think about the fact that there's a potential for the data that they're collecting, which is extremely sensitive at times. They're collecting data from students, they're collecting data on the network, and they're oblivious to the potential dangers of that. And so I think I'm talking about a broader conversation of where does that education take place and who is ultimately responsible.
So I'll talk a little bit about the journey that we're on, right? Because I won't say that we're perfect at this. It is a journey. We had the crisis that was the opportunity for us to elevate this conversation. And we certainly have made some, mistakes and misjudgments along the way. But it starts with, having a multidisciplinary conversation for us. We've defined as the academic administration, the business administration, direct faculty members, because they're the ones who influence each other to pay more attention to this problem, not the administration. And then, the IT community. And the IT community is so happy that whenever I make the statement, I always talk IT last, because, they're so, they're just beaten up from being, thrown into the middle of this with no support. So the fact that we create those conversations and we get around the table and we hash through sometimes very difficult conversations about how big is the risk and how to weigh the risk and balancing tests and what are the criteria by which we balance privacy from the need for protection, it's become a very robust dialogue. But it has to happen at each campus level. We can't just have that at a system level. It has to happen at each campus. At each campus, what I would say is that our goal is to have the academic senate leader have this a topic that he or she cares about on their agenda. We have something called a cyber risk executive at each location, who's kind of the person who's responsible to the chancellor for that topic, and then usually the chief information officer and information security officer, that they're really owning and driving the conversation locally. And I'll tell you an anecdotal story that was kind of funny to me, that all the conversation, all the pushing, all the arguments, all the reactions, trying to get people to take training. I was sitting in a committee that was a cross-functional committee with faculty members and other members of the administration, and the topic of basically our repository, our library, our system-wide library, where basically we want to make sure that scholarly publications all get tracked. One of the faculty members said, I got an email from them asking me if I wanted to put my latest publication in the repository. And my first thought was, is this real or is it fake? And I said at that moment to myself, we've made progress, right? If a faculty member has thought maybe I should question whether this is legit, then we've made a little bit of progress and just said, okay, now I know we just need to keep pounding this drum until we can figure out how we can touch everybody. So I think it gets better.
So what recommendation would you have to the commission in terms of what we can do that might make a difference here nationally?
Specifically for the universities around the country?
Universities of which some have hospitals and they have very secure networks around the hospitals and some don't. And there's very many varying levels of security awareness and privacy awareness at all across universities in this country.
I don't know that you should do anything or put anything in the commission report that would be unique to universities that isn't for the economy at large. Again, I think, to the point made, when we talk about security and expecting people flowing around our networks, open access, we're not that different than where we were 15 years ago. So I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
So aside from the security questions, there are the questions of how the data are used and how they're treated. And I think there's enormous need for education along these lines, even starting in college. If you're going to be training people who are going to go out and handle lots of data, there are certain things that they ought to know that are not covered in a standard security class. And the IRBs present a very delicate point here. You would not expect amateurs to roll their own encryption schemes. Why would you expect them to understand sort of the subtleties of working with data?
Thank you. And this is actually more a comment than a question, but maybe there's a reaction. I'm just listening to the discussion and the many mentions of workforce development education. It strikes me that there's education that policymakers and legislators need as well. And then I'm reminded of a famous course that I think is still being delivered here at Berkeley on physics for future presidents, which goes through the physics that a policymaker, in particular a president, say, might need to know. What does a president need to know about nuclear in order to be informed about future policy? And so it strikes me that cybersecurity or maybe computer science for future presidents could be also a viable course. And if you have any reactions to that, I'd be happy to hear that.
I mean, I think that's a great point, and I think that several of the universities that we support, including UC Berkeley, Stanford in particular, have tried to create boot camps, training modules, educational curricula targeted at decision makers in and out of government. And so I think it's a huge priority, and as more and more universities do that, I think you're going to start seeing modular curricula that's generally access it online. We're going to get some better open educational resources. There are already some great MOOCs. And if you want to learn about crypto and you're a policymaker, go on Coursera and watch Dan Bonet's Intro to Crypto class from Stanford. If you're a congressional staffer and you want to get smart on cyber, Stanford's also done that. Journalists, University of Maryland just did a boot camp for journalists and newspaper editors to educate them because they also play a key role in informing the policy debate. So I think you're exactly right. And I think that that's a great area where, the commission calling upon universities to think about that and also appetite from policymakers for that education and that training, I think is really important because I think there are also several efforts underway to train congressional staff and members of Congress because right. It's hard to make sound policy if you don't have the basic knowledge about both the technical and the non-technical dimensions of it.
Thank you very much.
Very quick follow-up on that. I did participate in one of those Stanford boot camps for congressional staff. I think that is a great thing. That happens at a scheduled time in August when they're not needed on the Hill, and so you do schedule that in advance. But I've also noticed in trying to train our employees this concept of an educable moment. There's a time when someone's ready to learn something about security because something just happened to them or to a friend of theirs. So I would I'd say get something prepared for when that crisis happens and be ready to roll it out like that.
Thank you very much. Kirsten, if you want to ask an R&D question, then we can move to close out.
Thank you, Tom. This is just looking at one of the missions of the commission. So one of our tasks is to create this R&D agenda. And there obviously has been one created by the government, but focusing on collaboration. And as a follow-on to Heather's point about given the barriers and to Pat's point about what we're missing, one of the reasons why we've asked the four of you here is because you represent these sectors that when collaborative, what could we produce? And I think to Eli's point around engaging the civil society, what would you identify as the priorities for that collaboration across these entities that the commission could put forth as a recommendation and as an action?
So I think that it's tough to prioritize, right, as always, because there are so many challenges here. On the one hand, I think on the educational front, I mean, trying to think about how you can really empower the multidisciplinary research and engage and provide the data and the experts and all of the connectivity there that's really required to generate relevant research. Because the last thing you want, and I fully respect, you know, research universities, but here I think we're talking about applied problems. And so you want to make sure that the research is anchored in real world challenges or challenges that are on the horizon that an intelligent individual can foresee. And so that means that you don't want to entrust academics to always just toil away without having a conversation with those who are on the front lines, whether at, you know, in corporations and or in government, to identify what the right problems are to research. And so I think that having much more of that conversation about, you know, how, you know, how can the commission frame the key questions that then can be tasked and universities can then really go after from a multidisciplinary perspective is a priority. I think another area goes to, I think rebuilding trust is something that we haven't, you know, didn't come as much, but I think is a real impediment to collaboration, which was the sort of two-part framework that was highlighted as far as you need trustworthiness. And I think that focusing on the trust piece, and I think engaging civil society is a unique vehicle to try to rebuild trust and to create new trust, not only between government and citizens, but between companies and government. And so that would also be a priority, in my opinion, as far as looking at how do you engage everybody from the civil liberties leaning groups to more of the national security think tanks to have, frankly, a more sophisticated conversation, to work together, to do research, to convene, to educate, to learn from each other, and just be more open than has happened in the past. You know, that I know is a little amorphous and vague, but I think that identifying ways that you can come at the trust deficit creatively is something that other panels and government entities have not done that much in the past.
My top priority would have to be setting time bounds on gag orders. I think that's something that if we don't get that, there's no way in the long term for me to really earn the trust of my users, either within the United States or abroad. And so that's the single most important thing I would ask of government.
My top priority might be trying to expose exactly what is being done with data and why and how often and where and by whom, both in research and in industry.
And I would say my top two would be the framework by which we move from university-sponsored research into applied research would be number one. And then the second one is, and this kind of gets to the immense nature of this challenge, how we build agility into our ecosystem here and how we work together. Because 5 years from now, we'll be talking about this topic, but the flavor will be different than what we're dealing with today. So it has to be something that we can be agile as well as sustainable.
Thank you all very much for your time and Angie, you put into your comments. On the federal government role, Eric, I do take away your point that the best thing the government can do is to set a good example, and that is going to be one of the first principles that we're going to pursue on the commission as a first order priority. Thank you all very much. And so in terms of timing, we're a little late, but I propose that we start the next session at 2. And so we'll be off a half hour if we get the staff to notify the speakers. Start here at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you all very much.